Okay, welcome to episode 3 of the English, what is it? Poetry and English Literature podcast. We have decided to literally just press record on this episode.
So, in at the deep end, Dan, I'd say. So at the end of the day, neither of us know the first thing about the subject that we've picked here.
Yep, that's true.
So it should be an interesting rollercoaster ride of imbecility and just drivelling, I suppose.
Did you want to say anything at all as a, is the right word, coda? You know, something that you might say after something? I don't know if that's the right word or not, but about our last podcast, because I think we had said it sort of afterwards, or perhaps we should take a moment to just sort of like reflect on some of the mistakes or lack of information that we had.
I reflected a great deal on the mistakes and the lack of information, but not in a way cogent enough to make any significant adjustment to it. What I would say is that I felt like we missed a small trick on the outloom life like Faustus line from Meeting.
Oh yeah.
Because obviously Faustus is himself against the devil, and then the goat on the rock is the devil. I don't think we ever made that comparison entirely clear, that of course Faustus was a character who came up against the devil. And we mentioned all of these things in passing, but we never quite put that together in an explicit way.
Okay, definitely
didn't.
I would say surprised to hear you begin with that, because I thought I had canvassed that idea. And that idea had been sort of comprehensively dismissed.
No, well, you should listen again. Right, you never canvassed that idea. Right. Nice try.
Okay.
No, I think we never quite came across it. We mentioned Faustus, and we mentioned obviously the fact there was a devil involved. But in terms of that line, in the imagination of the narrator, of the character, the central character in that poem, he outloomed life like Faustus, which is to say he could cheat death and the devil. But then there was this experience with this demonic goat. And anyway, I just mentioned that.
Okay.
I felt like we didn't quite attack that head on.
Since this is the Poetry and English Literature podcast, and thank you very much if you are listening to us. I should then perhaps mention Faustus. It was a good thing. Faustus is Christopher Marlowe.
Yeah, man.
I would think he died in about 1593. So I think Faustus is probably
murdered in a bar fight,
1591, something like that.
Fine.
Drawing on, I don't know where Marlowe would have read about the German story. He certainly didn't make it up. I guess there was a very famous earlier version that we don't know about, that Marlowe would have drawn on.
No doubt.
But probably Marlowe's best known work. Certainly his best known work.
Unquestionably his best known work.
And then, of course, Goethe's Faust and many other reworkings across different mediums. Yeah. Okay, so we're here. You have a copy of a book in front of you.
I do.
What tell us a bit about the edition that you're...
I got it off of eBay. It's an Everyman's Poetry, cheap as chips edition. It's the selected poems of Edward Thomas, who was... very prolific as a writer of literary criticism, biography, fiction and sketches. Did not write any poems whatsoever until he was nearly 37. He took up his poetic pen, found his muse, and was killed 2 years later, at the age of 39, at the Battle of Arras, I believe. I may have that wrong. He started writing poetry in December 1914, while he was obviously out fighting the First World War. He was an English soldier, and so his poetic output is all written in the 2 years he was in action in the First World War.
I think we should give a shout out here, a shout out to the new film 1917, which is coming out.
We haven't seen it yet, but it sounds like it will be very good. It's shot by Roger Deakins. That's always going to be an exciting day in the cinema for me, since he's the greatest cinematographer currently working.
Okay, what has he done?
Well, most of the films of the Coen brothers,
okay,
going back quite far, including films like Fargo, Big Lebowski, right. The Man Who Wasn't There, No Country for Old Men, True Grit, and so on. But also shot things like Kundun for Scorsese, that's his one Scorsese movie. He's also shot Blade Runner 2049. He shot The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward, Robert Ford. His career goes back, I think, to, I'm not quite sure, The Kitchen Toto by Harry Hook, I think was his first film. Then 1984. With Richard Burton and John Hurt, but his filmography is enormous. Sicario, okay, recently. I mean, he's the greatest cinematographer.
Well, reading about Edward Thomas, and I think it's a bit mysterious to me how we've settled on Edward Thomas. I think I saw a copy of this edition. I've got a slightly different edition to you. I saw this in the Oxfam bookshop. It's the Penguin English Library Selected Poems and Prose.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's about 1980. This edition. Yeah, first published in the Penguin Library in 1981. And I'm not sure how, really, truly, how we came to alight on Edward Thomas.
You suggested it.
Yeah.
I never heard of him.
No, I know absolutely nothing about him.
He might be dreadful.
Other than that, I've had a look at this book. But he, I think, you know, it's interesting, obviously, this film coming out in 1917, his dying in 1917.
He was buried on my birthday.
Was he?
Killed the day before my birthday.
Yeah, that is tragic. And at the very end of this edition, perhaps it's relevant to say up front, there is, I don't know if you've got it in yours, extracts from his diary, which go from, I think, which were found in the 70s by his grandson, which go from 1st of January to the 8th of April 1917.
Well, he was killed on the 9th of April.
Right, so I guess he didn't fill in his... Killed. It's hard to fill in a diary as it is, isn't it, without, you know...
Yeah. Having been killed by a blast of a shell at the start of the Battle of Arras.
Yeah.
And he was buried in the military cemetery at Angy one day later. But slightly poignant detail here was that he wrote his last poem, which was written in January, which was written in his diary, as he embarked from Southampton, presumably for his last tour. In March, there was the publication of an annual of new poetry containing 18 of his poems under the pseudonym of Edward Easterway. He takes up his duties at his observation post in Burain that day. And then the 4th of April, he sees the Times Literary Supplement review of his poems. And then 5 days later is killed.
Right. So a bit of background on Edward Thomas. He's born in, well, you've just said he was 39 when he died in...
He was born in 1878.
1878.
It was a Welsh parents.
Yeah, and he went to St Paul's School in London, and then on to Oxford.
Yeah.
But I think he, I read one of his short stories, I think it was called Hawthornden, which is a fictional story. It's quite depressing. He basically talks about going out. The premise of the story is this idea about you're always back in time for tea, and I think you get a real sense of Edward Thomas. And I know it's you're not supposed to necessarily infer autobiographical information from every aspect of a story, but he's basically there in real life. Edward Thomas was there with his wife and his kids. I think he was struggling to earn a living as a writer, and that's. I think he always aspired to do something beyond the sort of commercial tasks which he managed.
Yeah,
to
Yeah, he was beset with severe depression and suicidal.
Right. Okay. Well, that's that is very consistent.
The early tens.
I think he goes, and in this story, he goes out and then he just dies at the end. The character in it, whatever his name is, the sort of rather tragic thing is he's sort of going out for a walk and his wife says, "You're always back in time for tea," and it's like I think it's this tension between his. His sort of commitment to his wife and family and his sort of desire to be...
His son was born while he was still an undergraduate, incidentally.
Right. So, again, well, classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, classic thing. So he writes a pretty good... He's known as a nature writer. He writes the text for books, which are illustrated books, I guess, which you might think sort of coffee table-ish kind of books that we're familiar with.
He described himself as a hurried and harried prose man.
A hurried and harried
prose. And then having found poetry in December 1914, as we said before, he suddenly began to write poetry and produced 142 poems in 2 years.
Shall we bring this prologue to an end with my ident?
Yes,
and then
absolutely.
Launch into
One of the poems.
One of the poems. Okay.
Okay, well, we're going to read The Manor Farm. Neither of us have ever seen this poem before, read this poem before, but Danny tells me that it might be one of the ones that's anthologised and therefore likely to be either one of the best or one of the most characteristic of Thomas's prolific output.
Yeah.
Okay, The Manor Farm. The rock-like mud unfroze a little, and rills ran and sparkled down each side of the road, under the catkins, wagging in the hedge. But earth would have her sleep out, spite of the sun. Nor did I value that thin gilding beam more than a pretty February thing, till I came down to the old manor farm and church and yew tree opposite, in age its equals and in size. The church and yew and farmhouse slept in a Sunday silentness. The air raised not a straw. The steep farm roof with tiles duskily glowing entertained the midday sun, and up and down the roof white pigeons nestled. There was no sound but one. Three cart horses were looking over a gate drowsily through their forelocks, swishing their tails against a fly, a solitary fly. The winter's cheek flushed, as if he had drained spring, summer, and autumn at a draught, and smiled quietly. But 'twas not winter. Rather a season of bliss unchangeable, awakened from farm and church where it had lain safe under tile and thatch for ages since this England, old already, was called merry.
Okay. Okay, right, well, fantastic. I'm going to...
Just dig in.
Dig in. The Manor Farm.
Are you going to go through another reading?
Well,
do it. No, no, do it. Let's have it twice. It's dense. I love it.
The Manor Farm. The rock-like mud unfroze a little, and rills ran and sparkled down each side of the road under the catkins wagging in the hedge. But earth would have her sleep out, spite of the sun. Nor did I value that thin gilding beam more than a pretty February thing till I came down to the old manor farm and church and yew tree opposite, in age, in equals, its equals and in size. The church and yew and farmhouse slept in a Sunday silentness. The air raised not a straw. The steep farm roof, with tiles duskily glowing, entertained the midday sun, and up and down the roof white pigeons nestled. There was no sound but one. Three cart horses were looking over a gate, drowsily through their forelocks swishing their tails against a fly, a solitary fly. The winter's cheek flushed as if he had drained spring, summer, and autumn at a draught, and smiled quietly. But 'twas not winter, rather a season of bliss unchangeable, awakened from farm and church where it had lain safe under tile and thatch for ages since this England, old already, was called merry. Okay. So I will just say that it is February, and it is Sunday, and it is midday.
Yep.
And he is in the countryside.
He sure is.
In a very, very different environment to that which we spend our days. You mostly spend yours between here and London, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I spend most of mine here in the town. And he is talking about something quite different, although not completely alien.
Not at all, no. It seems like his good poem could have been written this year, considering it's... what year is this? 1914? 106 years old coming up.
There is, you're right. There is no kind of evocation of
period whatsoever. And if anything, he's working directly against that, isn't he? And trying to create a sort of ageless sense of this little hamlet.
Yeah.
This sleepy hamlet.
Yeah. That's right.
It's got a bit of Gray's Elegy about it, in fact, it seems to me. The awakened from farm and earth where it had lain safe under tile and thatch, you know, that kind of stuff. It's got a little bit of that about it, strikes me.
What is being awakened from farm and church?
Well, according to this, it a season of bliss unchangeable.
Is this a very patriotic poem?
This England, old already, safe under tile and thatch for ages, since this England, old already, was called merry. Yes, I think it probably is. I think possibly he's currently, at this point, he's only just started writing in December. It's now February. He is, I believe, in France and is possibly homesick and writing a memory, perhaps. And writing about, I mean, it's a little bit, I mean, I always think, when I think of the First World War, weirdly, I always think of the Shire, you know, and the hobbits having to go to Mordor and throw a ring into the pits of Mordor, wherever it is. And I always think of, you know, the boys leaving the Shire. And I feel like this is a little memory of the Shire of England, you know, such as you might have once you reached Mordor, a little reverie of England, of your home, you know, and there is a melancholy about it for certain, you know, I mean, the line that strikes out at me is the one use of the word I. Nor did I value that thin gilding beam more than a pretty February thing till I came down to the old manor farm. You know, it's very personal, isn't it, that? You know, he's talking about his, but he's talking in the past tense. He's talking about a memory, if you like.
It's quite somber. I don't know if you want to hear this last paragraph. I dimly recall having read this, one of his last essays, possibly his last essay before he went away. This England, it's called.
Do it.
I may be wrong, but let's have a look. He concludes with this paragraph. Basically, he says he's going around the country and reflecting on it. Then one evening, the new moon made a difference. It was the end of a wet day, at least it had begun wet, had turned warm and muggy, and at last fine, but still cloudy. The sky was banded with rough masses in the northwest, but the moon, a stout orange crescent, hung free of cloud near the horizon. At one stroke, I thought, like many other people, what things that same new moon sees eastward about the Meuse in France. Of those who could see it there, not blinded by smoke, pain, or excitement, how many saw it and heeded. I was deluged in a second stroke by another thought, or something that overpowered thought. All I can tell is, it seemed to me that either I had never loved England, or I had loved it foolishly, aesthetically, like a slave, not having realised that it was not mine unless I were willing and prepared to die rather than leave it as Belgian women and old men and children had left their country. Something I had omitted, something I felt had to be done before I could look again composedly at English landscape, at the elms and poplars about the house, at the purple-headed wood betonian, with two pairs of dark leaves on a stiff stem, who stood sentinel among the grasses or bracken by hedgeside or wood's edge. What he stood sentinel for, I did not know any more than what I had got to do. That is the end of his prose career.
That's the end of his prose career? Blimey.
Yeah. End in the sense that he then
started writing poetry and then was blown to pieces.
Yeah. So, he's reflecting now. His experience of England has changed. Hence what the quote you just offered. Nor did I value that thin gilding beam more than a pretty February thing till I came down to the old manor farm and church and yew tree opposite, in age, its equals, and in size.
I don't really know what I'm going to say about this poem. I mean, immediately I like it. But it seems very self-contained. It doesn't feel like it's opening itself up to analysis particularly beyond the scene he's painting for us. It's rather like looking at John Constable's The Haywain and then attempting to find the subtext. There isn't really a subtext, I don't think, particularly here. It's a bucolic vision of England. It would be very interesting to know precisely the circumstances, as I say, where he was when he wrote this, because if he was, like, you know, up to his elbows in Dead Men and Trench, then that would be a different thing again, of course. But taken at face value in and of itself, it seems to be fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
It's a charming vision with a personal slant. With natural imagery, cheek by jowl with this sleepy Hamlet, you know, this detail. Now, I don't really understand what he's driving at, particularly with that last stanza. There's only two stanzas in this poem, by the way. It may not read that way when we read it out loud, but there's one large stanza which ends a solitary fly, and then the final stanza is the winter's cheek, flushed as if it had drained spring, summer, and autumn at a draught, and smiled quietly. But 'twas not winter, rather a season of bliss unchangeable, awakened from farm and church, where it had lain safe under tile and thatch for ages, since this England, old already, was called merry. I don't really understand that last stanza particularly. The winter's cheek flushed.
I don't want to get too carried away here. But is it a little bit like The End of Jerusalem, the play, the Violante play?
Yeah, I know the play, yeah.
You know, because there's that intense personification, if that's the right word, of winter. But then he goes on to say, but it was not winter. It's the winter's cheek flushed, yeah, etc. But it was not winter. Rather, a season of bliss unchangeable. So it's not one of the four seasons, whatever this is, but a season of bliss unchangeable, i.e. eternal, and I don't need to explain the meaning of the word unchangeable. Awakened from farm and church, where it had lain safe under tile and thatch for ages, since it's a spirit, isn't it? Metaphysical is not the necessary word, but it's a spirit, yeah, that's awakened here.
Yeah. Which is ancient.
Yeah.
It has lain safe under tile and thatch for ages, since this England, old already, was called merry. So England's...
It's like this ancient spirit.
Yeah, beyond. I mean, we think of merry England, the old England being merry, but even then it was old, because it's so incredibly old.
Yeah.
That even our memory of history is of an old place. Yeah. So this is the weird old England back beyond the mists of time.
Yeah.
That's always existed in this hamlet before, yeah, yeah, church or farm were built.
Yeah. And I wonder whether there is...
It's in the land. It's of the land.
Yeah.
It's the spirit of England, if you like.
Yeah. I really don't know what his kind of... His beliefs were, but there is definitely a belief there, as you've just said, in a spirit which exists in the land.
I think we should move on. We can always refer to this poem. I think another poem might help us understand this one.
Okay.
Well, do you know what I mean?
If you are listening and you're still listening, I think, you know, just thank you. We're a little perplexed by it, but we like the poem a great deal, and I hope you did too, although we might not have been able to explicate it
fully yet.
Okay,
but we'll come back.
I'm gonna give you my eye then, and we'll move on. Okay, so our next poem, the next Thomas poem, is Haymaking, and we're just going to say something about when it was written. You've got a slightly different edition there.
A slightly different edition. Well, mine is laid out by years in strict chronological order.
That's handy.
It is. So this one is towards the end of 1915. Yeah. The previous one was, I mean, it's extraordinary how many poems he wrote in 1915.
Is there a 1914 section of poetry?
There is, but he started writing in December, so all of that's from the last month.
Right.
That whole chunk there.
December 1914, there's a chunk of your book.
Yeah, and that includes the poem we just read, The Manor Farm. So that's one of his first poems,
right.
The Manor Farm.
Right.
Then he starts writing in earnest with the poem, start funnily enough, called The New Year, which starts the 1915 section, and then quite far down, so I'm assuming that's most of the way through 1915, must be October or November, he writes this poem, Haymaking. The reason that we've picked this one is because we saw that in a 1915 book that he anthologised called This England, he picked these two poems, The Manor Farm, and Haymaking was the other poem he wrote for, he included in that anthology.
So this is super exciting. So this is literally, we have never read this poem before.
No idea what it's about. No idea. Although I did just read very briefly in the momentary pause there that you know, these were elegiac poems for an England which he felt was already passing away before the war, which was then hastening its decline. So there is a mournful, melancholy aspect to these poems to do with a world that was slowly vanishing, and now by the end of 1915 was vanishing extremely quickly. I mean, by the end of 1915, most towns, hamlets, in villages in England would have lost a lot of their young men. So I mean, we'll be talking about these poems being written and published in an environment of great sorrow and devastation.
Right, but I suppose also, as you were saying, it's not just the war, it's the whole Thomas Hardy kind of the end of the country way of life, the end of...
Yeah, increasing industrialisation and so on. Yeah, I mean, the technology starting to be, you know, make major inroads into the traditional English
I think we should just, because I know you're there's very few questions that you don't offer some kind of an answer to, but this one is a bit of a googly. I'm going to bowl you here.
Do it.
Okay. Do you know anything about haymaking?
Yes.
What a surprise.
No, I don't know a great deal about haymaking. I mean, I know that, you know...
Well, hit me up. Broadly, bearing in mind this is 1915.
In 1915, I would imagine that it was done almost exclusively, you know, entirely with the... in the traditional method, with a scythe, and you would scythe down your hay.
What, by hand?
Well, you would have ploughed the field with a plough horse, wouldn't you? With a horse and plough.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have had a combine harvester, would you? You would have had to have chopped your hay down in some fashion or another.
Did they have sort of horse-drawn combine? Well, not combine harvesters, but did they have horse-drawn ways of cropping the crop?
Possibly. I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I mean, it doesn't sound like a bridge too far for technology, does it? I mean,
no. And then they sort of bundle it up into massive great bundles.
Yeah, and you've got to dry it in the sun, which is what hay bales are and haystacks are. They're drying them, aren't they?
Yeah.
And letting them decay.
And then what do you use hay?
You feed it to animals, and you use it for making beds and stuff for animals, and that's what you put in your stables and stuff.
And they...
You've got to make hay while the sun shines.
Hey, right.
You can't get in the rain. That's one thing we do know for sure. Don't want to get too wet.
So there's a season already.
Well, it'd be the end of September, summer, wouldn't it? I would have thought, yeah, September sounds about right, yeah.
Maybe late August.
Yeah. Okay, let me just start reading it and we'll see where it gets us. Okay. We've never read a word of this before. Haymaking by Edward Thomas. After night's thunder far away had rolled, the fiery day had a kernel sweet of cold, and in the perfect blue the clouds uncurled like the first gods before they made the world, and misery, swimming the stormless sea in beauty and in divine gaiety. The smooth, white, empty road was lightly strewn with leaves. The holly's autumn falls in June, and fir cones standing up stiff in the heat, the mill-foot water tumbled white and lit with tossing crystals, happier than any crowd of children pouring out of school aloud. And in the little thickets where a sleeper for ever might lie lost, the nettle creeper and garden warbler sang unceasingly, while over them shrill shrieked in his fierce glee the swift with wings and tail as sharp and narrow as if the bow had flown off with the arrow. Only the scent of woodbine and hay new mown travelled the road, in the fields sloping down park-like to where its willows showed the brook, haymakers rested. The tosser lay forsook out in the sun, and the long wagon stood without its team. It seemed it never would move from the shadow of that single yew. The team, as still, until their task was due, beside the labourers enjoyed the shade that three squat oaks midfield together made upon a circle of grass and weed uncut. And on the hollow, once a chalk pit, but now brimmed with nut and elderflower so clean, the men leaned on their rakes about to begin, but still, and all was silent, all was old, this morning time, with a great age untold, older than Clare and Cobbett, Moorland and Crome, than at the field's far edge the farmer's home, a white house crouched at the foot of a great tree, under the heavens that know not what years be, the men, the beasts, the trees, the implements, uttered even what they will in times far hence, all of us gone out of the reach of change, immortal in a picture of an old grange.
Okay.
Yep.
Haymaking. After night's thunder, far away, had rolled, the fiery day had a kernel sweet of cold, and in the perfect blue the clouds uncurled, like the first gods before they made the world and misery, swimming the stormless sea in beauty and in divine gaiety. The smooth, white, empty road was lightly strewn with leaves, the holly's autumn falls in June, and fir cones standing up stiff in the heat. The mill-foot water tumbled white and lit with tossing crystals, happier than any crowd of children pouring out of school aloud. And in the little thickets where a sleeper forever might lie lost, the nettle creeper and garden warbler sang unceasingly, while over them shrill shrieked in his fierce glee the swift, with wings and tail as sharp and narrow as if the bow had flown off with the arrow. Only the scent of woodbine and hay new mown travelled the road. In the field, sloping down park-like to where its willows showed the brook, haymakers rested. The tosser lay forsook out in the sun, and the long wagon stood without its team. It seemed it never would move from the shadow of that single yew. The team, as still, until their task was due, beside the labourers enjoyed the shade, that three squat oaks midfield together made upon a circle of grass and weed uncut, and on the hollow once a chalk pit but now brimmed with nut and elderflower so clean. The men leaned on their rakes about to begin, but still, and all were silent, all was old this morning time with a great age untold, older than Clare and Cobbett, Moorland and Crome, than at the field's far edge the farmer's home, a white house crouched at the foot of a great tree, under the heavens that know not what years be, the men, the beasts, the trees, the implements, uttered even what they will in times far hence. All of us gone out of the reach of change, immortal in a picture of an old grange.
Well, it does share some aspects. I think it's a superior poem to the previous one. It's got a little bit more about it. But obviously it does have some of the same thematic ideas flowing through it, obviously.
Yeah.
This is more explicit, I think, in terms of what its subject is. This is speaks much more eloquently to the idea of time, not time passing, but a time passing, you know, an era ending.
Yeah.
And about change in the affairs of men and the landscape and so on.
I mean, you mentioned Constable. I mean, obviously, yeah. Haymaking.
Yeah, the haywain, of course, yeah.
But, I mean, you mentioned spontaneously Constable with regard to the manor farm or the old manor, or whatever it was called. And this one absolutely is that, isn't it? Because you've got the wagon, the long wagon,
yeah, the team of horses. Yeah.
Without its team, because the horses are enjoying the shade,
yeah.
As are the labourers. It's summer. It's summer.
Yeah, it's a beautiful well crafted poem. This, I think, obviously it should be just said, just formally speaking. Obviously, we're in rhyming couplets.
Yeah.
With an extremely, extremely loose approach to meter, it strikes me. It seems to alternate between 10 and 11 syllables. Not alternate, but seems to be arbitrarily between 10 and 11 syllables per line. Yeah. Not in iambic pentameter. Extremely loose approach to pentameter, anyway.
I like the mill foot water tumbled white and lit with tossing crystals. I'm struggling to place. Is this? There's obviously a mill, right? Millfoot water, or I don't know what that means really. I mean, there's flowing water.
Yeah, I don't know what a millfoot is. I think a millfoot is probably a piece of equipment, isn't it? Tumbled white and lit with tossing crystals, happier than any crowd of children
flowing,
pouring out of school and out.
Water, it could be a water mill.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah. But I mean, a millfoot,
yeah.
I assume, is a piece of... It might be the thing that turns around a water mill.
Yeah.
I don't know that expression at all, no.
A sense of the... it's quite cinematic, isn't it, in a way, at the beginning. The night's thunder had far away had rolled.
Mm.
So it's like the clearing of the dark skies to open up on this halcyon scene, this sort of perfect scene. And in the perfect blue, the clouds uncurled. Similarly here, like the first gods before they made the world and misery. So it's almost like in this scene there's... It's pre-lapsarian.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, it's before
misery.
Before
was
misery
created.
Was even created. Yeah, they're swimming a stormless sea in beauty and in divine gaiety. It's an idyllic,
yeah.
As you say, pre-lapsarian world.
Yeah,
which is paradise actually, a form of paradise.
Yes.
A perfect blue.
Yes.
It's idyllic. I like. The fiery day had a kernel sweet of cold.
Yeah,
which is nice. That's the presumably that's the river, the water, the river, and the shade maybe.
Yeah,
that there's this little cool moment in the in the baking heat of
that's
the
right.
haymaking
that's
and
right.
the sweat.
That's right.
That there's this pause, this stillness and this coolness,
yes.
which he's walked into and he's kind of stumbled upon it. He is not one of the haymakers, is he? He's an observer.
Yeah.
He's an outsider. He's wandered past it, and he's in the same way as he's wandered past the manor house or manor farm rather in the previous poem.
Yeah.
Here he is again, you know, whatever he's doing, walking out walking with his dog or whatever, and he's just seen this bucolic scene of kind of pastoral perfection, which has caught his eye, and he's describing it for us in this very visionary and kind of immaculate detail, trying to pull out these little...
Yeah.
Carve out these little details.
Well, I mean, I don't know where Thomas... I mean, presumably people who know about these things would know about Edward Thomas, but you sort of feel like he could be due for a bit of a renaissance. I don't know. All was old this morning time, with a great age untold... what we would today rather prosaically call a sense of heritage.
Oh yeah.
You know, and that would be to mislabel it because that kind of trivialised.
Well, these things have become slightly cliched now anyway,
yes.
haven't they? The whole concept
yes.
of the Little England and the and the whatever it is, the you know, the smack of leather on willow and the man running up to bowl
they've
and
become,
all that stuff,
cliched,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And should we just quickly attempt to... Well, Cobbett, I get
that. Oh, I was about to... You're anticipating me. So I'm going to give you a pop quiz just before you go. There's four... He says older than... He gives four names. Clare, Cobbett, Morland and Crome.
I can only do two of those. Okay. Cobbett is going to be Rural Rides, William Cobbett's great survey of England's rural areas.
Yeah.
William Cobbett, which was about... It's written in, I think, about... 1760-ish, 1770 maybe.
Ooh, interesting. I would have gone a bit later. But I could be wrong. I would have thought more like the turn of the century, 1800.
It could be. I'm no expert.
Clare,
John Clare.
Nature poet. Actually, who uses this same form of rhyming couplets.
Right. Morland don't know, Crome don't know.
No, never heard of Morland or Crome. Interesting.
No,
presumably
ignorant.
English nature poets.
I would assume
for
so,
those
yeah.
people who are interested in English nature poets, I will certainly go and find out who Morland and Crome are. But I think I picked it up also in the other poem, and I don't want to over-intellectualise this. I mean, it's an evocation of a time which will go, and they here are in this scene, but he says that all of the men, the beasts, the trees, the implements... uttered even what they will in times far hence, because in the distant future all that will be left is a picture of this scene, like a painting.
Yeah, like the Haywayne, yeah.
In an old Grange.
Or a photograph, potentially, in a photograph here, 1914, 15.
But the point, yeah, or a photograph. But the point I had to make was his time reference seems to be possibly characteristic of the earlier 20th century, in that he is evoking this ancient time, but I'm not sure how much was sort of popularly understood or known in the kind of, I don't know if there is a world, I'm sure there is in German, a word, I'm sure there is in German for a kind of, you know, the general kind of intellectual perspective that people had, because he says older than Clare and Cobbett, but that's only going back a couple of hundred years.
Yeah.
And Moreland and Crome, I don't know how far back that is. And he reached in the other poem to go back to before, you know, old England was old even then, when it was merry. That's another evocation of the past.
Yeah.
That they've been doing this scene for a long time. And I guess in his own terms, he's right, because probably that scene had been going on for a long, long time.
Yes, absolutely. But now he's saying that this is going to pass away, or is he saying that? I think he is, isn't he? He's saying, under the heavens that know not what years be, i.e. the massive span of time.
Yeah, the first gods before they made the world, they're swirling in under the heavens that do not know what years be.
And all this here that I'm looking at, the men, the beasts, the trees, the implements, uttered even what they will in times far hence. What does that mean?
I learned something yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I say I learned something, that's a complete lie. Ever since I was 25 years ago, I have never known the meaning of the word hermeneutics in an academic context. And every few years, including 25 years ago, every few years ago, I must fucking find out what hermeneutics means. Anyway, it being used heavily in this book I was attempting to read the other day, so I thought, I must try and find this out. And apparently it means something like, I've forgotten already. I have literally forgotten already.
Perfect.
No, it means something like that things convey information. So it basically means like interpretation of something. So like the hermeneutics of this cup or something is what we read into this cup, what it tells us.
Okay.
So I don't know what you can read out of this cup. But I think it's like it's a hermeneutic point, because he's saying, when he says uttered, like uttered even what they will in times far hence, what he's talking there is that they are conveying some kind of meaning.
I see.
They have a hermeneutic, and they uttered even what they will in times far hence. So when you behold and see this scene, it is speaking to you. It is telling you something.
Oh, I see.
And you can interpret what it's telling you. Uttered even what they will in times far hence.
Yeah, whatever they might mean in the future, whatever this might mean.
No, they're uttering the same thing. That's what he's saying. Oh, he's saying that they uttered even what they will in times far hence. So the meaning that they are conveying is the same now as it will in times far hence.
Oh, all of us gone out of the reach of change.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, that's a subclause. They're telling us what they will in it's the same thing even in times far hence, when we're all gone and out of reach of change.
Yeah.
Immortal in a picture of an old Grange. He doesn't say what it is that they are uttering, what they are conveying.
Fine.
And that's the kind of slightly, I mean, it's not mystical, but it's,
well, again, it's this spirit of England thing, isn't it? Which we found in the earlier poem. It's slightly left slightly undefined. Well, I mean, that was the mystery of the previous poem of the Manor Farm, because we didn't really know.
It was just called a season changeless or something.
A changeless, unchangeable season of bliss. Yeah.
And here,
it was defined by what it wasn't. It wasn't the winter. It was an unchangeable season of bliss that had woken up. And here it's this situation, this vision that he's having of these men and the horses and the trees and the water and the coolness of the afternoon, the stillness and the silence, the age of it all.
I think the achievement is, like, and this is an evaluative kind of judgment, but it's uninflected by anything else, isn't it? It's so straightforward.
Yeah.
It would be, I mean, to just straightforwardly kind of evoke and feel this sense. I'm just quickly scanning my memory or databanks for something else where this could be. I mean, I sort of thought the end of Jerusalem again, where he summons Brutus Albion or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's that. But where else? Just like, where else one might? I'm sure there are lots of other examples of this, but I can't think of anything that's quite so committed exclusively to this idea.
Not to this bucolic idea of one thing, one aspect of English life, the pastoral English life. I mean, if you look at something like, Larkin, let's say, The Whitsun Weddings, which is a poem I know well, you know, which is the outsider looking at the people of England, as it were, not in a disparaging way, but in the little people of England, the everyman
totally
of England.
It's totally disparaging. It's a totally disparaging
word. It's fond, but it's disparaging. Yeah, okay. Fond. No, it is fond. It is fond.
Oh, there's what is it? They're magic moments, so huge and holy
farcical. That's oh, success. Yeah, of course. I've never known success this, so yeah, huge yeah, and holy yeah. farcical. They're seamy foreheads.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah, no, you're right. But suffice it to say, it's not that part of it that's so different. Well, the thing that's really different about the poem is the fact that you are seeing it so clearly from the point of view of an arch observer, an outsider. That's much more a poem about himself, whereas this isn't so much a poem about Thomas. You don't really get to know Thomas here, do you? You don't have the no. I. It was no. fleetingly in that other poem.
You don't at all. Yeah. And it's not inflected with any, as I say, the Whitsun Weddings is obviously the opposite, in it's completely inflected by his
yeah.
perception.
He's all about his vision of it. You're always with him, yeah. looking out of his owlish, you know, eyes and his yeah. glasses and his point of view. So it's very radically different from that. Yeah, I wasn't really making the comparison between the two particularly, to say that they're so different. Okay.
I mean, I suppose maybe, if you think about maybe A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
You know, that's... But, I mean, that's obviously so clever and...
Full of magic.
...sophisticated and different. But, I mean, there's a... Yeah.
This is more like a snapshot, isn't it? More like a painting.
Yeah.
You know, the detail of it and trying to convey the light and shade.
Yeah.
And the detail of the nut and elder and the garden warbler. The mill foot, you know, the nettle creeper, all these details, the yew, the oak, etc. You know, he's very specific.
Yeah, and this painting thing, I mean, he really does somehow. Although this scene is actually teeming with people and animals, you know, there's the horses, obviously all the birds and all the rest of the stuff, but there's the horses team, and there's all these agricultural labourers.
The tosser.
I don't know whether that's a person or a big sort of fork, but either way, it's a classic line.
I think probably that is actually the fork, yeah.
Yeah, but they don't, you know, obviously, as you say, there's a silence and a stillness to it, which is quite impressive that he's achieved that with all of this stuff kind of going on.
I think
because they're at rest and they're in the shade.
I think it's the repetition actually of still. Line 26, he says, the team as still until their task was due.
Yeah.
And then a few lines later, down at line 33.
Yeah.
Or 4. The men leaned on their rakes about to begin, but still. And all were silent. All was old this morning time with a great age untold. You know, that seems to be... really doubling down on this idea of the stillness. We already feel like we're watching something really still, and then he's saying, yeah, 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 but really still.
Yeah.
Really quiet, silent and still. And we get, again, it feels like that drowsy fly that was harassing the horses in the previous poem could still be whirling about in this poem, you know what I mean? It's hassling these horses. You know?
Well, there's a huge amount of sibilance as well. The hollies, autumn falls, the fir cones standing up stiff, tossing crystals, little thickets where a sleeper forever might lie lost. So I think that is probably a technical...
Yeah, shrill shrieked.
...achievement.
In his fierce glee. Yeah. It's a good poem. I really like it. I mean, it's very evocative. Again, I don't feel like it's really wanting to be opened up to some kind of deeper meaning interpretation in quite the same way as we had to pass Ted Hughes, for example, where you feel like you're having to shuffle the pieces around until they make sense.
Yeah.
This poem feels like much more of a straightforward account of a vision of a sort of, as I say, a sort of pastoral idyll. I mean, in a way, the deeper meaning, as I say, is the contextual meaning of it being in 1915. This poem written in 1910 would have had a rather different meaning to it in 1915, when these haymakers, these boys from this pastoral hamlet, had all gone off to Mordor to throw a ring into the mountain, you know.
Right.
And this life in the Shire was coming to a abrupt and violent conclusion, for
So all of us gone out of the reach of change.
Dead.
There's an undercurrent.
But immortal, but only in a picture of an old grange. There's a real poignance to that when you understand where he is at this moment, and he's
Well, you've done exactly what you said you weren't going to do, which was a sort of add meaning to the poem.
The contextual context,
So actually, now I read it, it's much more sad than I thought, because that's right. He says, "All of us gone out of the reach of change,"
but it also
in a picture of an old grange.
But it also means that, the first gods before they made the world and misery. What is that misery he's talking about? Well, I mean, you only have to, travel a few hours across to France, and there it is, right there. That's the world and misery, isn't it? That's unfolding on, mainland Europe, that these boys are plunging in, millions, or hundreds of thousands and millions, from 1915 probably. Coming back, irreversibly altered.
I think if we have got anything therefore to say about this, I think it's that, isn't it? And it's would this poem be anthologised? I mean, maybe it has been. I don't know. In a book of First World War poetry, would it be recognised as a First World War poem in that sense of your Owens, your Sassoons, your.
Well, it's not about the war, but it's about, I suppose, if you like, it's the opening scene of Gone with the Wind, isn't it? it's her on the swing talking to the boys. It's before, as you say, it's prelapsarian. But obviously, given that, anyone reading it in 1915 or the end of 1915, they would have understood its context immediately, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll pause on this one.
Yeah, let's do it.
Give our ident if I reach over and grab my Asian prayer bowl.
Hang on, you're back. Oh. Double bubble there on the old Asian prayer bowl. I was just saying to Dan, we had a momentary break to get a cup of tea there. And I was just saying to Dan, it seems, as we're just briefly looking for the next one to do, bear in mind we don't know anything, that as you get further and further into this book, I'm now looking towards the end of 1917. And, 1916. Generally, it's the end of 1916. The poem seemed to be, A, more explicitly about the war and much sadder, not surprisingly.
Right.
So there's a couple that look interesting here. Gone Again, and it's As the Team's Head Brass. What do you want us to do, Dan?
I think we should do As the Team's Head Brass, but you've got your quite nicely sort of chronological order there. So where does this...
Well, this falls very close to the end of 1916. Not the end of 1916. There's only one poem in 1917, which he wrote in January 1917, which is called Last Poem. Right. And it's bracketed as The Sorrow of True Love, which is the opening line, or part of the opening line. So in terms of 1916, we're talking about this being very much towards the end of the middle.
Towards the end.
Yeah, so most of the way through 1916. There's many, many less poems in 1916 than there were in 1917.
1915.
1915, yeah.
Okay.
And there's only one in 1917. So the vast majority of his output is the last month of 1914 and then the whole of 1915. And then I'm guessing that probably about 1/7 or maybe even 1/6 of the poems are from 1916. Okay. And then there's one short poem from 1917.
So there's fewer poems in 1916.
Yeah, presumably he was busy doing a war.
We don't know when in 1916.
But certainly I'm guessing the second half of 1916.
Yeah. And I don't know...
A year out from his death,
right? I'm sure you could easily find out... I don't know, but probably you could, whether he, you know, the leave, I don't know how it quite worked out with the soldiers. They were deployed, then they came back for a bit, and they went back out. And it was like that. So he could have come back, or he's writing from memory in France. I don't know which.
Well, the immediate poem before is talking about the bugle call in the morning, and... the bugle call this morning. So that's the immediate poem before, which is called No One Cares Less Than I. So I'm assuming at this point he is in action, although the next poem, Bright Clouds, is talking about the war again. So yeah, I'm assuming he's at war at this point. I don't know. Okay. I shall read it.
Good.
As the Team's Head Brass by Edward Thomas. As the Team's Head Brass flashed out on the turn, the lovers disappeared into the wood. I sat among the boughs of the fallen elm that strewed the angle of the fallow and watched the plough narrowing a yellow square of charlock. Every time the horses turned, instead of treading me down, the ploughman leaned upon the handles to say or ask a word about the weather, next about the war. Scraping the share, he faced towards the wood and screwed along the furrow till the brass flashed once more. The blizzard felled the elm whose crest I sat in by our woodpecker's round hole. The ploughman said, "When will they take it away?" "When the war's over." So the talk began, 1 minute and an interval of 10, a minute more and the same interval. "Have you been out?" "No, and don't want to, perhaps." "If I could only come back again, I should. I could spare an arm. I shouldn't want to lose a leg. If I should lose my head, why so, I should want nothing more. Have many gone from here?" "Yes." "Many lost?" "Yes, a good few. Only two teams work on the farm this year. One of my mates is dead. The second day in France they killed him. It was back in March. The very night of the blizzard, too. Now if he had stayed here, we should have moved the tree. And I should not have sat here. Everything would have been different. For it would have been another world. Aye, and a better. Though if we could see all might seem good." Then the lovers came out of the wood again. The horses started. And for the last time I watched the clods crumble and topple over. After the ploughshare and the stumbling team. So I slightly mangled the reading of that, I think.
No. Well, so I'd have a go.
Yeah, difficult because of the dialogue. Beware.
Yeah.
Whose voice you're in.
Yeah. As the team's head brass flashed out on the turn, the lovers disappeared into the wood. I sat among the boughs of the fallen elm that strewed the angle of the fallow and watched the plough narrowing a yellow square of charlock. Every time the horses turned, instead of treading me down, the ploughman leaned upon the handles to say or ask a word about the weather, next about the war. Scraping the share, he faced towards the wood and screwed along the furrow till the brass flashed once more. The blizzard felled the elm whose crest I sat in by a woodpecker's round hole, the ploughman said. When will they take it away? When the war's over. So the talk began. 1 minute and an interval of 10, a minute more and the same interval. Have you been out? No. And don't want to, perhaps. If I could only come back again, I should. I could spare an arm. I shouldn't want to lose a leg. If I should lose my head, why, so I should want nothing more. Have many gone from here? Yes. Many lost? Yes, a good few. Only two teams work on the farm this year. One of my mates is dead. The second day in France they killed him. It was back in March, the very night of the blizzard, too. Now, if he had stayed here, we should have moved the tree. And I should not have sat here. Everything would have been different, for it would have been another world. Aye, and a better, though if we could see all might seem good. Then the lovers came out of the wood again. The horses started, and for the last time I watched the clods crumble and topple over after the ploughshare and the stumbling team.
Well, that strikes me as a little bit of homespun philosophy there, and I think the critical line they're talking about the second, the last part of the poem. Now, if he had stayed here, this dead workmate, then we should have moved the tree. To which Thomas responds, "And I should not have sat here. Mm. Everything would have been different, for it would have been another world." This is the sort of, you know, dare I say, the sliding doors concept here.
Yeah.
the farmer responds, "Aye, and a better. Though if we could see all might seem good."
Yeah, it's a classic kind of, you know, if we had total godlike understanding, then
this might be okay.
Yeah.
So in the grand ocean of time, this may be all, you know, a necessary part of the process of God's vision or God's view of, you know, God's what's the word, you know, the roles we're all playing are all playing out in a harmonious fashion if we could see the bigger picture.
Yeah.
But for us, this all appears to be terror and tragedy.
Yeah.
And loss.
Yeah.
Quite a philosophical position to take towards the end of 1916.
Yeah, it is. It's a recognition of you know, our smallness and lack of perception. It's a very it's a position of great humility.
Yes. I'm interested also in the lovers and how they disappear into the wood and then come out of the wood again.
Yeah. That seems quite constructed in a way. It gives it a kind of it happens at the very start and then at the very end.
Yeah, it has an almost mythical quality to it.
Yeah.
The lovers coming out of the wood again.
But it's also their slot. I mean, it's not to say that they're oblivious at all. In fact, he leaves us to think about that, doesn't he? Let's say that they're a rustic couple, you know, from As You Like It, a swain and his whatever.
Beauty, yeah.
And it's, we don't know whether they're oblivious. They're certainly, their life is continuing, going on, despite the context of the war behind them.
Yeah.
But then maybe he's in there saying to her, "Well, I'm about to go away and fight." So it's double-edged. It's ambivalent.
Sure.
But it evokes the sense that, and particularly just so directly, the lovers. You know, it's the human relationships and emotions and
life is going on.
Life is going on. But it also ends, doesn't it? The horses started, and for the last time I watched the clods crumble and topple over after the ploughshare and the stumbling team. It's the last time. So, yes, on the one hand, he had to get back, or whatever. This is a poem written from recollection, I think, isn't it? Because this is before...
He's gone.
He's gone. And I think he was agonising. This is in a way, I think, if we went further into it, you said that they would get sadder because we're now realising, actually, what these poems are about.
Yeah.
Which is the tragedy of the First World War
and the emptying out of the countryside of its men, of its young men, you know, and the reality that it's having back home, you know, the tree that doesn't get pulled out of the field, and the loneliness of the ploughshare, who's just, you know, there with his horse, and all of a sudden this bucolic way of life that we've witnessed in the previous poem.
Yeah, in fact, it's quite a good counterweight to the other one, isn't it?
To the haymakers,
because this is like going back into the haymaking poem, but now
it's depleted of its life and its the vitality of the team. Now it's just one guy on one horse, you know. It's a very sad poem, it strikes me, this one.
Yeah, because he says the horse is starting, for the last time I watched the clods crumble, so there's intimation of
finality, things coming to a close.
And he must have known. I mean, he's resigned to the fact, his fate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's what this poem in a way is about.
Yeah. Yeah, he's about to follow on back to France.
Yeah. But in that kind of Edward Thomas-y way, it's the countryside, it's the ploughman, and that sense of slowness, because the conversation takes place only every time the ploughman gets back from the other side of the field.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Yeah. There's an interesting detail here that the tree and the workmate died on the same day.
Yes.
And they both died in the blizzard.
Yeah.
The blizzard felled the elm whose crest I sat in.
The ploughman said.
Yeah.
And then he says, yes, that it was back in March, the very night of the blizzard too.
Yeah. Now, if he had stayed here, we should have moved the tree. So there's a kind of a symmetry between the falling tree and the fallen workmate.
And I wonder if, you know, I don't know, but there, if he is agonising, or he was agonising about whether or not what his role in all of this was, i.e. he, Edward Thomas, there's a sense, isn't there, that, yeah, he hasn't gone. This is before he went.
Yeah.
And he's sitting on the tree, almost connected to this dead guy out in France. And he's saying why he doesn't... and it's quite nice the way the ploughman just says, and don't want to... Have you been out? No. And don't want to, perhaps.
Yeah.
And then he expresses his fear. If I could only come back again, I should. I could spare an arm. I shouldn't want to lose a leg. If I should lose my head, why? So, I should want nothing more. So he's, and then that ellipsis there. Have many gone from here? It's like he's a train of thought.
Oh wait, I feel like I have to get back to the bottom of this. The truth is, he enlists in 1915. Age 37, he enlists in the Artists' Rifles. I don't know what that is, but that sounds like it. And he also publishes This England, incidentally, which contained the previous two poems we read. In 1916, he publishes his book about Keats, and he's an officer cadet at the Royal Artillery School, Handel Street, London. He moves his family to High Beach in Essex. And then in November, he is commissioned as a second lieutenant.
Lieutenant,
and he is posted to 244 Siege Battery, Lydd, in Kent. And then in December of 1916, he volunteers for overseas service. He doesn't actually go to France until January 1917, when his last poem is written. So he's not writing these in France at all. He's writing these from England, not having gone. Bear in mind, he's 37 or 38 in 1916. So he's not 22 and sitting there listening to a ploughshare talking about dead men, dead boys. He's a 37-year-old guy who is deciding to go to war, which is a totally different situation entirely, isn't it? I mean, he's a mature man with children at home, and he's deciding he's going to go and fight the war, having had presumably many conversations like this. It's even more heartbreakingly sad than it was a moment ago when you realise that, yeah. He's not been to war. But he's hearing these stories everywhere he goes, every day, in the countryside he grew up in, the countryside of the manor farm that he's walked around every day of his life, and seen these bucolic scenes, you know, of the English country life. And now, by 1916, there's an absence, and there's a loss, and there's sadness that's falling all over it. Many lost, yes, a good few. Only two teams work on the farm this year. One of my mates is dead. And this is just at that point, towards the end of 1916, where he is now in training and deciding to go, and then goes presumably just a few months later, which is also the end of his poetic career.
And maybe the lovers are part of the rationale for going, which is that, you know, the country's going to carry on. People will still be here. And it's... what's he going to do? Where does he fit in, as you've rightly just said?
Yeah. and it really does bring to bear, you know, the everything I've just said.
The fact
really
that it's actually real. It's a bit like when Joe was watching The Great Escape yesterday, and he said it's really scary, because we told him it's based on a true story. Obviously, I googled Great Escape afterwards, and I realised that it's not obviously strictly true, but it's quite... There was an escape of 76.
Most aspects of it are true. I mean, they all got machine gunned by the Gestapo in real life. That happens at the end of The Great Escape. No spoilers.
No. But he said it's so scary.
And it was an international team out of Stalag Luft 3, whatever it was. It was an international team, wasn't it? Made up of all the different nationalities.
And he said it's so scary because it's real. Yeah. Like, it really happened. It was a tense scene where they're trying to... James Garner and Donald Pleasance are trying to steal an aircraft and get over the border to Switzerland or wherever.
And Donald Pleasance is going blind.
He's gone blind.
He's the forger. God, that's so good. Anyway, we really mustn't get onto The Greatest
Game. No, but the point is that, I mean, it makes it, as you say, it's sort of dawning on us, isn't it, as we're reading this. It's real.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And that is something which transforms the relationship which you have with it.
I mean, it certainly brings out that last couple of lines. Then the lovers came out of the wood again, the horses started, and for the last time I watched the clods crumble and topple over after the ploughshare and the stumbling team. I mean, he is talking about the last time. He's saying goodbye to England. And it was the last time. You know, a couple of months later he's at the front, a couple of months later he's dead. You know, this is the end of, you know, life as he knew it, of English country life and of his own life, ultimately. You know, it's the catastrophic destruction of the First World War, you know, is right there on that poem, you know, in a microcosm.
Yeah.
I think we should just move straight along.
Okay.
To the last poem.
Right.
Presumably, there were more poems that he wrote when he was there, and that did not survive him being killed, because he's very prolific in 15, fairly prolific in 16. The last known poem is from January of 1917, and he wasn't killed until the April. So one might assume that he... I've just found a bunch of stuff about the end of this book about these poems. I'm just going to see if there's anything useful. John Clare, William Cobbett, George Morland, and John Crome, who were both painters of rural scenes and landscapes. Ah, so it's interesting that
there were painters.
They were painters, yeah.
Ah, when does it give dates for when they were?
1763 to 1804 for Morland, okay. And 1768 to 1821 for Crome. And I'm just going to see if there's anything useful about the poem we just read. No, there isn't. It was written on the 27th of May at the team, as the team's head brass. So it was in the middle of 1916.
What is this one we're going to read now?
Last poem is written on the 13th of January. I mind you, he was killed on the 9th of April. This is the last poem. It was on the last page of the diary Edward Thomas kept during his final 3 months as a soldier, and it was first published in 1971.
Okay.
So, last poem, brackets, The Sorrow of True Love. It is, by the looks of it, a sonnet.
Crikey.
A Shakespearean sonnet.
Is it?
The sorrow of true love is a great sorrow, and true love parting blackens a bright morrow. Yet almost they equal joys, since their despair is but hope blinded by its tears, and clear above the storm the heavens wait to be seen. But greater sorrow from less love has been, that can mistake love of despair for hope, and knows not tempest and the perfect scope of summer, but a frozen drizzle perpetual of drops that from remorse and pity fall, and cannot ever shine in the sun or thaw, removed eternally from the sun's law. How about it, Dan?
Well, I don't know if I've got that poem. I've listened to you reading it with interest in me. Okay, I'll give it a go. The sorrow of true love is a great sorrow, and true love parting blackens a bright morrow. Yet almost they equal joys, since their despair is but hope blinded by its tears, and clear above the storm the heavens wait to be seen. But greater sorrow from less love has been, than can mistake lack of despair for hope, and knows not tempest and the perfect scope of summer, but a frozen drizzle perpetual of drops that from remorse and pity fall, and cannot ever shine in the sun or thaw, removed eternally from the sun's law.
It's a fairly simple poem. I mean, presumably we could infer, given that it's from January 1917, when he's going, leaving his wife and children, that he is saying that his great love, this sorrow that he's leaving his great love, but he's saying this sorrow isn't. He's basically saying it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And he's saying that a lesser love is obviously a greater sorrow still, because you have never known the wonder of a great love. So he's consoling himself with the idea that even though he's having to say goodbye to a great love, the parting is such a great sorrow, that that at least he's had this, you know, monumental love, and it's not just the perpetual drizzle of the mediocre love, you know.
And I think that obviously was a huge part of his life. He was was committed to his wife
and family. Yeah.
Well, but I think, you know, I don't know whether it's worth. We're sort of getting over the hour mark, are we? I think it would be worth finishing with the 8th of April, which is the last page of his diary.
Do it.
So, I mean, to put this into perspective, these last entries, they're all sort of short paragraphs. You know, they begin for the 4th of April, for example, up at 4:30, blackbirds sing at the battery at 5:45, fresh cloudy morning, showery, cold, muddy, and then artillery makes air flap all night long, so they're being shelled. The 8th of April is the last entry in his diary. A bright, warm Easter day, but Achicourt shelled at 12:39. And then at 2:15, so that we all retired to cellar. I had to go over to battery at 3 for a practice barrage, skirting the danger zone, but we were twice interrupted. A 5-9 fell 2 yards from me as I stood by the FC post. One burst down the back of the office and a piece of dust scratched my neck. No firing from 2 to 4. Reuben left for a course. And then it says, square brackets, on the last pages of diary are these notes. The light of the new moon and every star, and no more singing for the bird. I never understood quite what was meant by God. The morning chill and clear hurts my skin while it delights my mind. And then a prose paragraph. Newville in early morning with its flat straight crest with trees and houses. The beauty of this silent empty scene of no inhabitants and hid troops. But don't know why I could have cried and didn't.
Bleak old ending there, Dan. Yeah.
I think we've sort of, in this hour, gone from not knowing anything about Edward Thomas to...
wanting to know something about Edward Thomas.
Well, to sort of discovering a bit about who he was.
Yeah, just a little bit, yeah. I'd be interested in reading his war diary.
Yeah. So, I'm going to just try and say a few words in summation. I mean, when you're dealing with these First World War themes, it's just so moving and so obviously...
Dreadful.
But I feel like his is a testament, and a valuable and a vital testament, and a beautiful testament to his experience. And his poetry is... as you say, it doesn't really want to be interpreted. It is what it is. It's direct.
That's a good word.
But nevertheless, very effective. And I think, you know, we're not going to go into a practical criticism session of the sort of achievement, the sort of craftsmanship. But it's evident in the effectiveness of his poems that they're behind all of that is obviously a very skilled and experienced writer.
I would just quickly say, I'm just browsing through the book now, that just from a formal point of view, there's an extraordinary range of formal approaches here. There's
Yeah.
There's four line stanzas. There's seven line stanzas here in this poem. Two houses.
He was actually. I say know nothing about him. Obviously, like yourself, I sort of glimpsed at it at the book. He was a close friend of
Robert Frost.
Yeah. They apparently discussed both in person and in correspondence, poetry and what it should be and so on. So,
well, also he's not like, I mean, we're talking about the comparison with Wilfred Owen. I mean, Wilfred Owen, I forget how old he was when he died, but I mean, he was
25.
Yeah, I mean, he's a young guy. Siegfried Sassoon, I think, was young also. In fact, younger still, right?
Right.
So we're talking about Edward Thomas as a First World War poem. He was of an older generation. I mean, he could have been the father of.
Yeah.
Those guys, and just in years, I mean, a guy of 37 going to the front is a very different prospect than a guy of 22 going to the front, or a guy of 18 going to the front. You know, he's not one of the boys, is he? I mean, he's turning up there as a mature man who's got a history of, you know, a storied history of literary criticism and letters behind him. He is a cultural figure. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that he went at all. I have to say, I kind of get my head round. Whether that was a common thing for people to do, to enlist at the age of, well, he would have been 36 when he enlisted, or 35 or 36 when he enlisted in 1916 or 15. Sorry, that's my phone going off. Probably the call to arms, so to speak. No pun intended.
Okay, right.
Yeah, let's pause it for a sec.
Okay, wrap it up.
Yeah, well, I don't know what we'll discuss next time. We'll come back. Well, thanks very much for listening, everybody. We'll have a think about what we're going to hit next. Maybe we should come something a bit more modern, or something much older. Maybe we should go deep into the mists of time.
Well, I should think that, and thank you, as Robert said, for listening to this podcast, as you obviously have done, and bearing with us. The style of this podcast, our credo, if you like, is that we are just going to pick things up and have a look at them, things that we don't know or we do know a bit. And obviously today this was really kind of new stuff for us, and we were discovering it. I hope you've enjoyed joining us on that journey. And I think next time, there's no real point in us saying now what it's going to be, because we probably will decide
on the day.
So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much indeed. Oh. Bingo.